Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike, and with me, as always, to talk about Twin Peaks on this
is
edition.
Is the condemned woman,
is the
Hannah.
So what's the name of the episode we're covering today?
Oh, gee, it's called The Condemned Woman.
Okay, so this is the 16th episode?
Yes, indeed. Sweet 16.
Sweet 16, the 16th episode of Season 2 of Twin Peaks. And so Hannah, please tell us a little bit about the episode we're going to be talking about tonight.
Okay, synopsis says, Truman puts Hank in prison for the attempted murder of Leo, while Hank points the finger at Josie for the murder of Andrew Packard. Albert reveals that Josie shot Cooper. Ben enlists the help of John Justice Wheeler.
All right.
It is directed by Leslie Linker Glatter and written by Trisha Brock.
Excellent. So good to see the return of a season one stalwart with Leslie Linker Glatter.
I'd also just like to say that Trisha Brock, according to IMDb, is known for Killer Dilla.
Killer Dilla.
Yeah.
It's very catchy.
Just a guitar-playing car thief meets an autistic savant piano player, and together they transform a group of reluctant halfway house convicts into the Killer Dilla blues band.
Wow, that sounds like
that is
Oscar
quite the movie.
What a concept. So that is the episode we will be talking about this evening. Quick bit of housekeeping before we do that. Just a reminder that we appreciate feedback. Come on, guys, you're killing us. We need some.
I have got some, by the way.
Oh, okay, cool. That's a chin stroke for Spencer, but it's not. It's a rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Maybe that's why we haven't been getting any feedback, because I've been saying the wrong email address. And also, you can leave comments on our YouTube channel as well, and we'll read those out if it feels appropriate to do so. We are also on Twitter and Instagram. In both cases, we are at rewatchproj. That's rewatch, P-R-O-J. Reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, very much appreciated. Check out our friend shows too, including Chinstroker vs. Punter, his film, her movie, Film Bastards, The Good, The Bad and The Odd, and the Talk Without Rhythm podcast, and Entertainment Landfill. And I think that's all of the housekeeping. There's nothing else I need to mention or promote. I think that's...
I think that's it.
That's everything. Okay, Hannah, so feedback. Yes, you say we have some.
We have an email called Season 2.5.
Okay.
Alex from LA here. Sorry I haven't written for a while. This year has been a doozy, so I had very little time, but have been listening and wanted to let you know that I'm still loving the show. This second half of Season 2 is really interesting, and I almost see it as Season 2.5 as... and I think you two have alluded to this, it feels like its own thing. I almost break Twin Peaks up into the following phases, all of which are connected but definitely have their own flavour.
Oh, interesting.
One, the pilot, shot a while before the series, almost completely on location in the Northwest and has a vibe of its own. Two, season one, kind of the cultural phenomenon phase of the show, more studio-bound with a really focused tight story and incredible momentum, the water cooler phase of the show. Three, the expanded universe. The majority of this was created during the Imperial phase of the show's first season and includes stuff like Laura's diary, Cooper's diary / tapes, the access guide to the show, the board game, the audiobooks and all that stuff. Really enriches the mythology of the show. 4. Season 2, Episodes 1 to 8. The dark horror and almost sci-fi of the end of the Laura story really has a feel of its own during this run of episodes. 5. Season 2.5, the lighter, quirky town era of the show. 6. Fire Walk With Me speaks for itself, the darker sister to the show. 7. The missing pieces, in brackets, all the deleted stuff from Fire Walk With Me.
All the what, sorry?
The deleted stuff. 8, The Return / Season 3, plus Mark Frost's two books that came out at the same time. Curious to see if you agree. Keep up the great work, Alex. It sounds pretty good to me, but I'm sure you have far more to say about how he's broken that up than I do.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I think that they all are very much their distinct phases, and I like the fact that Alex has sort of separated out the pilot as well, because the pilot does have its own kind of, it looks different. It's got a kind of weird, almost coldness to it. I think largely because it was shot physically on location. And TV show was shot in California. So a very different kind of, I guess, just colour. And, you know, the air's different there. But I agree all of that.
And in pilots are always interesting in that even if it's a show that is kind of, the characters are already cemented and, you know, they know what they are going forward. Pilots always have a slightly different flavour to the rest of the show.
Yeah, no, inevitably they do. And I like the fact that Alex has also separated out things like the expanded universe and, you know, and there are, I mean, like that, I mean, we talked about how those first eight episodes of season two feel very contained.
Absolutely.
And it almost feels like Twin Peaks, the show, is just a delivery mechanism for a lot of ideas, you know, and I kind of like the season three, like Twin Peaks The Return, it's kind of using Twin Peaks as a delivery mechanism for this other thing as well. And Fire Walker Bee does the same. And, you know, it is interesting to view it that it's all this one big thing, but it's actually, it is a collection of smaller things that connect. And it is really interesting seeing that there are certain things that run through all of it, but there are certain things that are unique to those different phases as well.
Yeah.
You know, so no, that's really, really good food for thought. And I mean, I'd maybe even go one step further and say that the final episode of season two of the original of the show, that's almost its entirely its own thing as well.
You know,
Lynch came back and did that. And basically I didn't know this until relatively recently that Mark Frost had written a script for that final episode and Lynch basically came in and completely scrapped it and largely improvised the whole of the final episode over one solid 24 hours of shooting. Like they literally just filmed all day and all night and just went for it. Like they were making an art movie or something. And that's kind of crazy. And that was just basically a 50-minute art film that David Lynch made that grew out of Twin Peaks. So in some ways, it feels like Twin Peaks as a concept is almost like a petri dish for ideas that can come out. And some of those ideas run for a long period of time, and other ones are contained to a scene.
Yeah.
You know, so definitely. And that's a pretty unique thing. But okay, well, let's get to it. Let's watch this.
Thanks for your feedback, Alex, and good to know you're still listening.
Yes, we very much appreciate that. So, right, okay, so we're going to hit pause. We're going to watch the 16th episode of season two of Twin Peaks, and then we're going to come back and say what we thought of it.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies. Oh, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we're back, so we've just finished watching the 16th episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks. Hannah, I'm not going to mess around because it's nearly 10 o'clock and that's like the middle of the night.
Practically the night. I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it had a lot of really good, subtle stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly love Audrey in this episode. You can see such an amazing progression in terms of where she started in the pilot.
And how much her hair has grown over 2 weeks.
Well, 100%. but just in terms of her interactions with Jack, like if she had met him before everything that she's experienced, she would be far bolshier and trying it on, seductive, you know.
Yeah.
Give zero shits, go for it.
Or, well, it's difficult, or the other way, and being kind of like conversely being a bit too try hard.
No, I think she would just be very...
If you look at how she was with Cooper.
Yeah, but, like, happy to put herself out there. Whereas, like, when they're having that dinner together and she just kind of says, I'm only 18.
Yeah.
Was a really poignant moment for her because she realises just how young she actually is rather than thinking, well, I'm practically an adult, you know.
The play acting.
Yeah. I thought that was really well done. And, I mean, Sherilyn Fenn's a great actress. But, yeah, I really thought that was particularly great. Harry needs to absolutely get over Josie. I mean, fuck's sake. You know, what's with the cradling her on the bed when she dies? Like, just...
Well, you know, it's the power of the vajazzle, isn't it?
Oh, he's been absolutely vajazzicized. speaking of jazzercise, actually, I'm loving Ben Horn's foray into the Richard Simmons look.
Yeah.
Loving the sticker celery and shell suit combination that he's currently sporting. There was just so much in this episode to enjoy. And it really felt like kind of the best of each character.
Mm.
Yeah, what about you?
No, I enjoyed it. It's very much it's another one of those kind of step in the right direction episodes. And it just feels that the show is just doing its thing and not trying. You know, there's a kind of effortlessness about it that Twin Peaks has when it's at its best. And it's an interesting one, this, as well, because... I mean, we'll get to it when we get to that point in the episode, or maybe we'll just jump around, I don't know. But it's interesting whenever you see creatives on the show who aren't David Lynch doing some of the really Lynchian stuff, like how they approach it differently, because with one exception, you know, the episode where where they solve the crime, you know, where Leland dies, we haven't really seen Bob or the little man in any non-Lynch-directed episodes.
Yeah.
And it's funny because you can kind of tell. Like, I like the fact that this episode starts moving back into all these. But in an odd way, you can kind of tell it isn't David Lynch.
Mm.
The way that those elements are portrayed is just slightly off. And I don't mean that critically, because it's good to see the show starting to re-embrace those mythological elements. But it is interesting to see something that's just so purely Lynchian through the prism of somebody else.
Yeah.
And also, I like the fact that this trend towards finding new and interesting ways to use the characters, one, now that the kind of binding context of the Laura Palmer investigation's gone, works. So, like, for example, seeing Audrey, Shelley and Donna together in the Roadhouse, you know, that's a pairing, a grouping, I should say, that you would never have seen during the Laura Palmer storyline.
I thought it was really interesting seeing Shelley say to Donna, are you waiting for James? And Donna was really like...
Well, just the fact that they know anything about each other's lives as well, because what are the connections with those characters, you know?
But it just made me realise that sometimes I struggle with reactions of some of the actors sometimes, like when Donna is really offhand and like... No, I'm not waiting for James.
Yeah.
It sort of said to me, okay, you have him absolutely pegged and you're leaving him to deal with his pain and you just, you know, forgive, forget, move on. Whereas the scene that you had with her and James earlier, it was like, I'll wait for you, my lover.
Well, this is the thing that we've talked about before, about how... this whole idea that different characters represent different genres.
Mm.
So when you see them in different groups of characters, they have to kind of adjust. It's a little bit like how in real life, were different people around other different people.
Yeah, whereas, that, this makes it very hard for me to know what anyone actually truly means.
But Twin Peaks takes it one step further because you're as soon as Nadine walks into a scene, you're in an entirely different kind of storytelling. And then when Norma walks in, you're in, again, a completely different mode of storytelling. But when you combine these characters, you know, and also the other thing as well is particularly with the characters like Donna and Bobby and Shelley and James, is this dichotomy of adults playing children, you know?
So do you think, like, I mean, like, let's take the Return season 3 out of it. From the scenes in this episode, is it your opinion that Donna is in love with James and waiting for him, or
my feeling is that she's almost, as weird as it sounds because of the end of a kissing, she's almost maternal to James in that scene when they meet and they're sitting on the gingham, you know. It's as though she's outgrown the relationship. James is still living in this romantic 50s rock and roll fiction, but she has grown out of that and realised, you know, this isn't going to work. And so when she says to him, look, you know, go, you're going to have all these adventures and come back and tell me about it, there's almost an element of, go on, champ.
But
you know,
she initially says, come back to Twin Peaks.
I think that she wants him to come home, but I think there's an element of pragmatism where she realises that kind of she can't clip his wings. He needs to go off, get all of this stuff out of his system.
Elsewhere.
And if it's meant to be, then he will return and they'll be together. Mm. You know. So I think that there's an element of she's just growing up a little bit. I think she would love for them to be together because she's in love with him. But I think that deep down, I think she's discovering the maturity to understand that it's not going to work. On a practical sense, she wants that, and it's just, and that's what relationships often are like: is the fact that you might want somebody, even though it goes against your better judgment, and even though you know that you need to be thinking with your head, not your heart. And I think that's what's happening in that scene.
But I think,
I think you're overthinking it.
Yeah, probably. Well, definitely. I mean, that's my modus operandi. You know that. I saw a pin, like a badge the other day that said, I am an overthinker. I thought I must buy that for myself. I suppose I find that hard to relate to because I'm either in love with a person and want to be with them, or I'm not in love with them and go off and do your own thing. And I'm very black and white.
I think that scene between
I can have affection for someone.
I think that
and
scene with
them.
Her and James, you see her going through that realization in the scene.
Right.
That's the point, is the fact that she goes from, oh, just come back to actually, you know.
That's a ball ache.
Just go. Go and do your thing.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. You know?
Well, should we get into it? Should we get into the
absolutely,
breakdown?
Let's do it.
Okay. So we open up with a shot of a miniature owl in front of a chess game. I've always wondered about how you've got this kind of death mask of Caroline, and everybody talks about how beautiful she is, but to me it just looks like a completely generic face. Because once you take the eyes and the eyebrows and all the features off somebody, faces just kind of look like faces.
It reminds me of, I can't remember what it is. I can't remember if it's a cartoon or if it's an 80s movie, but there was something where there was a white computer face. It just reminds me of that.
Yeah, well, I just think eyes wide shut. When I see those sort of things.
And nostrils. Yes. Yeah. All I see.
And, We get the breakfast scene with Pete and Andrew and Catherine. And they're carrying on like a couple of giddy schoolboys, you know, having fun with their breakfast. And it wasn't until I heard Andrew laugh that I was like, I know that laugh. And then I twigged and I was like, that can't be right. And I looked it up. Andrew played the lizard alien guy in The Last Starfighter.
Really?
You know, his co-pilot.
Yeah.
You know, he's got that, that laugh. I was like, that sounds like the laugh of the lizard alien guy in The Last Starfighter. I looked him up. That's him.
Wow.
And it's just like, what a bizarre piece. Because I just assumed it was somebody much younger than that in the role. But no, it's just an old dude in makeup.
Amazing.
We see Josie walk in and faint when she sees him. I do like the she looks surprised kind of moment as well.
Just the way they just leave her on the floor and have a little giggle about it.
They're just so casually awful to Josie. I mean, she deserves
it. You know. She's pretty casually
they
awful
all deserve
to
each other, don't they?
Yeah.
We see Hank go to see Harry, and he talks about how, and he makes a pretty convincing point. He's like, look, you know, what would your constituents think of you sending me down as opposed to solving, you know, the murder of a beloved, you know, town benefactor.
But, I mean, he gave the correct response in the sense that Hank seems to have got through life always having leverage in his pocket.
Yeah.
And I think Hank sort of realises that if that cycle was to be broken.
Yeah. Truman realises.
Truman realises that if that cycle is going to be broken, he needs to sort all the Josie stuff out a different way. Hank has to be his own thing.
Well, also, Hank doesn't actually have any leverage because they know all this anyway.
No, exactly.
You know.
Yeah.
So, Hawk, you know, kicks the crutch from underneath him. Some low-grade police brutality going on there. And you can see that Harry knows.
I did that to myself when I was on crutches.
Really? Yeah. You annoyed yourself. You're like, I'll show you.
I'm that much of a douche.
So we see, we can see that Harry knows that the situation is getting out of control here. Albert wants to book her. We see that Audrey is learning the business, and Jack Justice Wheeler with his acoustic slide guitar theme that comes in every time he wanders into the scene.
And super duper wig glue around the forehead look about him that is only visible in 4K.
Well, I mean, Billy Zane, he's one of the great kind of poster children for the Bald Brotherhood. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I've got nothing against the Bald Brotherhood. I'm married to one of the brothers.
Yeah. The monks.
I love a guy who rocks a bald look. Not as much of a fan of the strange wig.
Well, again, this is HD, isn't it? I'm sure that in 1990 you wouldn't have.
Honestly, the last time I watched this was not on a TV this clear, and it didn't.
But even so,
I
mean, Billy Zane and Sherilyn Fenn just make like an impossibly attractive couple, you know. And
unfortunately, I just keep thinking of him as the bad guy in Titanic.
I see. For me, Billy Zane will always be
the Phantom,
the guy in Demon Knight.
Oh, right.
You know, the Tales from the Crypt movie. That's why I go to. Well, in Twin Peaks,
I always think of the Phantom.
Yeah, I can see
in
that.
Titanic.
So we learn about the gathering of angels with the torn poem, as Shelley's the first one to receive that. We have the scene with Nadine and Ed where Nadine says, hey, you know, I think we're breaking up. Mm. There's some great kind of Blue Velvet-esque, classic Lynchian, Catherine looking through the slats in the door at...
not being in any way subtle.
No. Well, I mean, Audrey, when she did it, she was smoking. She was hiding in a wardrobe smoking, for God's sake. We see Cooper talking to Josie and basically saying, look, you know, you're going to have to turn yourself in, but I could arrest you now, but I want to give you the opportunity to, you know, do the right thing and make it easier for Harry. We see Josie pleading with Catherine, and you're getting the sense Josie's kind of like, you know, I think I'm going mad. I feel unwell. And at the time, you know, it plays as though she's just bargaining, and maybe that is what it is anyway, but obviously with what happens at the end of the episode, there's potentially more to it than that. And Catherine suggests that she goes to see Eckhart and essentially throw herself at his mercy. But what's happening, obviously, is that Andrew and Catherine are trying to engineer a situation where where Thomas Eckhart and Josie will try and kill each other.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a win-win situation for them. They're like, well, whoever loses, we win, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so we see Ben and Bobby. This is where we've got the tracksuit and the celery has replaced the cigar as mm-hmm. far as he's kind of, you know.
He sort of wields it in the same way as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I love the way he calls Bobby Bob.
Bob Briggs.
And he wants to save the little pine. I love the way every time he refers to it, it's the little pine weasel.
Mm.
And I think that one of the great things...
I love that the conniving mind is back. Like,
well, no, but I, you know, Jerry's like, oh, yeah, because you want to do all of this. And Ben's like, no.
He doesn't say no.
No, but he doesn't acknowledge it. And I genuinely think Ben is being sincere. I really genuinely think that Ben's... I think it's a mental health thing for him. But I think something snapped in him and he is genuinely trying to do the right thing. But the thing that's great about Ben Horn is...
No one trusts him.
But no, it's not just that. But the thing that's great about Ben Horn is that if it was being deceitful, he would probably convince himself that he meant it. So at what point is it real? You know, I mean, if he genuinely believes it, then that makes it real. But is he just genuinely believing it because he has to get kind of method acty to be believing? So I like the complexity of that.
Mm.
And I like the fact that it's played. I think it's played in that scene that when Jerry is saying, oh, because, you know, you want to do all of this, there's a nervousness to Jerry as though he doesn't quite, even he is thinking, I think Ben might actually mean this. And I don't think we're meant to be sure either way as the audience.
Mm. I like that no matter if he is serious or not, that no one's going to believe he's sincere.
Yeah.
Just because of who he is.
Yeah.
And you can see, like you say, like Jerry sort of trying to put his own understanding of it onto it. But also at the same time, you see Bobby and Audrey kind of slightly roll their eyes and go, fuck, is this the next civil war that we're going to have to sort him out? He wants to save a fucking pine weasel.
Yeah, exactly. So they can read it from that perspective. And I also want to point out that in 1990, I had a Save the Pine Weasel badge.
Of course you did.
So he talks about wanting to keep Twin Peaks unspoilt and fight for development. We see Wyndham Earl in the diner. We see Norma talking to Annie, her sister, mm-hmm. and she talks about how she always felt that Annie was from another place and time. Mm-hmm. It goes to Norma and says that as you get married, and Norma goes to Hank and says that she wants a divorce and he wants an alibi. And it's I love how many people have shaken the jail bars while shouting in Twin Peaks. That's like a it's like a. I kind of want to do that myself, just so I can say that I have, you know.
I like the fact that initially you think Norma is going to kind of...
fall for it again.
Be gentle with him or fall for it again. And then she just comes to her senses. She's had enough.
Yeah.
Which is lovely.
And she says, but, you know, I'd rather be his whore than your wife, you know. And Hank doesn't care. All Hank wants is an alibi.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And
he's, you know, he's only saying what he's saying to get into her good books so that she'll do what he wants.
We see that Albert has the final pieces of evidence and he's going to go and book her. I love the way that when we see Josie, it's a remake of the opening shot of the pilot. You know, when the camera pans across and she's sort of looking in the mirror, it's exactly the same as the beginning of... It's the first thing we see in the first episode. The first character we see is Josie looking in that mirror. So it's nice to see her character end the way that it began, you know, at the very beginning of the show. Donna and James have their little picnic and she says, you know, you'll come back with great stories and none of them will be about Laura and Maddie, you know.
Mm.
And that's the thing with James is it's almost as though he kind of... We joke about, you know, driving away from his pain, but it's as though he kind of needs to wash that off himself.
Yeah.
He
needs to have other experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we see that Andrew, or Andre, as my spell check has decided
Andre.
That Andrew
it's
and Eckhart.
It's the sexy version of him.
Do you think he knows Purple Wayne? Dear Andre, do you know Purple Wayne? He says that we see them in the lift and that Josie warned him off, and which isn't true. We know this.
No, you see him spin one story to Josie and then a totally different one.
And we've seen Catherine kind of go, there's a gun over here. I'm just saying, So, yeah, so they figure that they'll try and kill each other, and it's a win-win. Ben talks to Audrey and Jack about how he wants to learn goodness, basically. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that Ben's wearing a suit, but he's got like a polar neck on as well, so he's slightly groovier. And he puts his cigar out kind of symbolically when he's talking about the clean air. But I love the way he gets called away because the chef tried to stab Jerry.
I love that.
But it's the way he delivers the line. He's like, I'll be back in a moment. The chef just tried to stab Jerry.
I like how none of them question it.
Of course
he did.
Again.
Yeah.
We see Shelley and Donna smoking in the roadhouse and they get their notes. And I think what's really interesting is, and I've never actually checked this, but I'm pretty sure that the poem that Windham Earl sent them, I can't remember who it is. It's Yeats or Tennyson. It's some famous poet. But I'm pretty sure that the pentameter or the rhythm that it's in is what they based the Fire Walk With Me poem on, because it ends with, I've wrote the notes, what is all this sweet work worth if thou kiss not me? One chance out between two worlds, fire, walk with me.
Mm.
It just scans exactly the same way. So I wonder if when they were writing the Fire Walk With Me, they used this poem as a template, and now they've brought it back to create that subconscious connection that in some way these things are connected.
I have a bone to pick with all three of those girls. Why the fuck would you go to a place with a part of a note and a cryptic clue, given that a girl was murdered a mere couple of weeks ago?
But they caught the killer, and what are the chances of that happening again in the same town?
No, yeah. I'd either just not be going, or I'd be talking to Harry or Cooper.
I know it's complete television logic.
Yeah,
and that is what is happening there. We see Cooper practicing his fly fishing in his room when Catherine calls him. I like the way that on his bed, and I've never really noticed this before. You can only really see this in HD, but on his bedside table, there's his phone, a glass of water, his watch, a book about Tibet, and his Bookhouse Boys patch. They are the only things on the table next to him. But he bursts in on Josie, and we see that Eckhart's been shot. And I love how almost amused Eckhart is. He's just kind of like, such a Josie move, And she immediately goes into, he tried to kill me. She's just, a little bit like Evelyn in some ways. This kind of just, and Hank, just this desperate kind of attempt.
That life of doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just all automatic.
Yeah, exactly. It's all they know.
Mm.
Truman comes in. He's like, look, you're going to, and she has some kind of episode. And we see the little man and Bob. And then we see her in the doorknob.
Turn into a doorknob
in some very early 90s CG. And I like these moments because we're seeing the return of the supernatural elements to it. But also the idea of her going into the wood kind of reminds me of that thematic element that we talked a lot about in the earlier episodes, this idea of the encroachment of modernity, this idea that Twin Peaks is a logging town.
Nature will take it back.
Yeah, it will. It's kind of like the whole interior of the Great Northern is made of wood. And it's this kind of weird indoor-outdoor space that doesn't kind of make any sense. And if you look at it in the context of nature and life and the weird kind of liminal relationship between those things that we see in Twin Peaks, it kind of makes sense that a soul could inhabit that.
Mm. Plus, I am a firm believer in reality as well as in TV logic, that Mother Nature just kind of resets shit when humans fuck it up too much. And I think there's a little bit of that coming into play. Like, everything is unraveling for Josie, and Mother Nature's just kind of going, right, it's time you were a wooden doorknob.
That's just going to happen. And like, I like the way that, I mean, when we get to it.
Just
going to
sort that out.
When we get to it, I'll mention it, but it's never explicitly stated, but this is kind of revisited in season three. Mm. There's this one little subplot that's never fully explained, and I've always felt that it was Josie in the Great Northern. There's something in the Great Northern.
I vaguely remember and, something.
There's like a, like Ben can hear this sound. It has to be that. But again, it's Twin Peaks, and it's Twin Peaks made for cable by Mark Frost and David Lynch with nobody else. So, of course, they're not going to explain it, because they don't have to.
The CG for that, was that done through any kind of, like, it wasn't done through Lucasfilm?
No, I don't know. It was just done by the in-house people, I guess. Right. But I thought it looked pretty good, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was fine.
But any final thoughts, Hannah, before we wrap up?
I seriously enjoyed this episode. I think probably the most enjoyable for the last three or four, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Really thoroughly enjoyed it from start to finish. Looking forward to the next one.
Me too. Okay, quick reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com. Check out our friend shows at rewatchproj on Twitter and on Instagram. Reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And we also appreciate comments on our YouTube channel if that's how you listen to the show. What are we talking about next time, Hannah?
The next episode is called Wounds and Scars. Synopsis says, Harry sinks into a deep depression after Josie's death. Josie's body holds more questions than answers. Norma's troubled sister Annie arrives in Twin Peaks. Wheeler and Audrey hit it off. Cooper's stalemate angers Earl. It is directed by James Foley, written by Barry Pullman.
Alrighty, okay. Well, we will get to that sooner rather than later, hopefully, and we will see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.